I was in pursuit of another of my fetishistic look at what the wacky evangelicals are doing now stories when I landed in that megachurch filled with people speaking in tongues. My crew and I had traveled to New Life Church in Colorado Springs, a complex of large buildings perched atop a hill with sweeping mountain views. We were here to see the NORAD of prayer. Our guide was a super solicitous man of God by the name of Pastor Ted Haggard. Moments after I was jarred by his noisily reverent congregant, the pastor ushered me and my team out of the main sanctuary into the brisk Colorado air and then into a gleaming new $5.5 million, 55,000 square foot building about 100 yards away. We pushed through the glass doors and walked down a long hallway decorated with religious art, the crew backpedaling in front of Ted and me recording our conversation. Then we entered the main room, a rather astonishing space lined with enormous glass windows, at the center of which was a huge spinning globe. It was meant to be a sort of mission control for human communication with God, outfitted with computers and piping in news feeds from around the planet. "We're watching the whole world all the time for events that need to be prayed for," he told me with earnest excitement. Ted was what's called a prayer warrior, someone who believes in the power of targeted, intercessory prayer to affect real-world changes. "If there's any indicator that there's a problem, we notify hundreds of thousands of intercessors immediately." Ted was really excited about this place, although I got the feeling he could muster equal ebullience while discussing parsnips or annuities. He did, in fact, have the air of a man who could be a top regional insurance salesman. With his short, parted hair and his sparkling eyes, he had the Clinton-esque way of locking in on you and making you feel that, at least in that moment, you were the most important person in the world. He and his wife, Gail, had started New Life in their basement several decades earlier with a congregation of 22 people. It grew with fevered intensity as Ted led his followers on a sort of siege of the city, praying outside government offices, gay bars, and the homes of suspected witches. He and his troops prayer walked nearly every street in the city and even prayed over random names in the phone book, all in an attempt to chase the devil out of town. Undoubtedly, part of Ted's appeal was that he had a way of invoking Satan while remaining ceaselessly chipper. At the time of our visit, the church had 14,000 people on its membership rolls, and Ted was one of the leading lights in Colorado Springs, which, because it was home to many large Christian organizations, such as Campus Crusade for Christ and Focus on the Family, had come to be known as the Evangelical Vatican. He wore his authority lightly, though, insisting that everyone simply call him Pastor Ted. By now, the congregants had filed out of the sanctuary, so that's where we went to sit down and have our formal interview. As we talked, it became clear that Ted was a different breed from his fiery forebears on the religious right, figures like Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and D. James Kennedy. He was part of a new generation of pastors who were trying to broaden the evangelical agenda beyond gay marriage and abortion. In some ways, he was more like a self-help guru. He'd written a series of books on things like making your marriage last and saving your neighbors from going to hell. He'd even published a weight loss guide, The Jerusalem Diet. To be sure, he was against abortion and homosexuality, but he didn't go out of his way to talk about it. After the interview, as the crew was breaking down their lights and packing up their gear, Ted sat down on the stairs leading up to the main stage and patted the step next to him. My first instinct was to make an excuse, figuring this was going to devolve into some sort of proselytizing session, but to beg off would have been rude, so I plopped down reluctantly, only to be pleasantly surprised by the conversation that ensued. With the cameras off, Ted toned down his eagerness a notch and began speaking with a bracing frankness about the state of the evangelical scene in America. "Can we talk off the record?" he asked. "Absolutely," I said, thinking this could get interesting. "There's a huge difference between what I do as a pastor and what people like Jim Dobson do." Dobson was the head of Focus on the Family, whose main office was right down the road and was so large that it actually had its own zip code. Dobson was a pillar of old-school orthodoxy, a firebrand, and an avid critic of gays and abortionists. "I have an actual congregation that I see face-to-face every week," Ted added, So I see what their real issues are, like their marriages, children, and finances. If I'm consistently negative, it doesn't help them. Dobson, on the other hand, runs what's called a parachurch ministry. His ministry grows in the midst of controversy because that attracts interest and funds. I was a little surprised to hear a big-time pastor trash-talking another major figure in evangelicalism. It seemed a little unchristian. But it was certainly intriguing, and I was starting to like this guy. He was a bit of a paradox, over-friendly and yet likable, saccharine and also capable of knowing irony. I sat there on those steps well past the point dictated by politeness, and Ted patiently answered all the questions about evangelicalism I would have been too embarrassed to ask anyone else. He didn't make me feel inferior for being, as they call it in evangelical lingo, unchurched, and he didn't try to convert me. He was also not defensive at all when I asked how biblical literalists reconciled the fact that different books in the Bible said different things about key details in the Jesus story. He beamed mischievously and said, "We have our ways." Sitting there with Pastor Ted, I realized, with genuine regret, how unthinkingly judgmental I'd been, not only of Ted, but of religious people generally. It hit me that I'd blindly bought into the prevailing stereotypes. The Washington Post had once declared these people to be poor, uneducated, and easy to command. Pastor Ted's story about the inner clashes of the movement put the easy-to-command notion to rest. As for my assumption about all religious people being unintelligent, Ted clearly wasn't. Then again, neither were believers such as Tolstoy, Lincoln, and Michelangelo, not to mention contemporary people of faith like Francis Collins, the evangelical and scientist who led the charge to map the human genome. Not only had I been unfair to people of faith by prematurely reaching sweeping, uninformed conclusions, but I'd also done myself a disservice. This beat could be more than just a chance to notch more airtime. Most people in America, and on the planet for that matter, saw their entire lives through the lens of faith. I didn't have to agree, but here was my chance to get under the hood and understand what was going on. More than that, I could approach faith coverage as a way to shed light instead of heat. At a time when religion had become so venomously divisive, thoughtful reporting could be a way to take audiences into worlds they'd never otherwise enter, and in the process demystify, humanize, and clarify. It was why I'd gotten into the business in the first place, to both get on TV and do meaningful work. Shortly thereafter, I admitted to Wombo that he was right. We could start covering this beat with more nuance without having to move to public radio. I became so gung-ho about improving my faith coverage that in the spring of 2005, I packed a Bible in my luggage as I headed off for a reporting trip to Israel, Egypt, and Iraq. I figured if I was going to be a proper religion reporter, I should at least read the source material. It was right before I left on this trip to the Middle East that I had my last encounter with Peter Jennings. We met in his office, ostensibly so he could brief me on what my reporting priorities should be. He opened, characteristically, with an insult. "There's a perception," he said, "that you're not very good at this sort of overseas coverage." Even though I was reasonably sure this was untrue and probably just part of Peter's never-ending psyops campaign, I felt compelled to defend myself. As soon as I started to stammer out some sort of objection, though, he cut me off and lectured me about the various stories he wanted me to produce for his broadcast while I was abroad. Then he abruptly took a call from his wife, Casey. After cooing into the phone for a few minutes, he hung up and looked at me and said, "I have a piece of advice for you, Harris. Marry well, at least once." A few weeks later, I was sitting out on the veranda of our Baghdad bureau, Bible in hand, struggling to get through Leviticus with all of its interminable discussions of how to slaughter a goat. I stood up in frustration to go back into the office to check my computer, and that's when I spotted the message from Peter. It was a group email announcing that he had lung cancer. I never saw him again. By the time I got home, he had taken medical leave. Just a few months later, he was gone. Despite the fear and frustration he had provoked in me over the preceding 5 years, I felt enormous affection for him, and the night he died was one of the few times I could remember crying as an adult. Perhaps more than any other single person outside of my immediate family, he had genuinely altered the course of my life. He built me into a better journalist than I had ever imagined I could be, sending me all over the world, giving me the chance to get a taste of the same gritty global education that he, a high school dropout, had gotten during his years as a foreign correspondent. He could be a massive pain in the ass, but he was, in his own funny way, very generous. He was a restless soul, an idealist, and a perfectionist, a man who definitely followed my dad's price of security maxim. No matter how hard he was on me, I always knew he was exponentially harder on himself. Interestingly, during the entire time I knew Peter, the subject of his personal faith never came up. It wasn't until years after his death that I learned that Peter himself was not particularly religious at all. He hadn't needed faith in order to see that religion was a vital beat for us to cover. He was simply an insatiably curious reporter with a peerless instinct for what would interest the audience. Peter's death set off a ripple of reassignments among the on-air staff. The network's first choice to replace him was the anchor duo of Elizabeth Vargas and Bob Woodruff, the correspondent I'd met in the presidential suite in the Islamabad Marriott. Only weeks after his ascent to the big chair, however, Bob was hit by a roadside bomb in Iraq and nearly died, which sent the news division reeling. Charlie Gibson from GMA was then tapped to move to the evenings, while Robin Roberts was elevated to be Diane Sawyer's co-host. Meanwhile, Ted Koppel had stepped down from Nightline and was replaced by the troika of Cynthia McFadden, Martin Bashir, and Terry Moran. I was then tapped to replace Terry on the Sunday edition of World News, a promotion I considered to be incalculably awesome. In no way, however, did this step up the ladder reduce my neuroses about work. Quite the opposite, in fact. Yes, it was insanely great to be given the steering wheel of the news division every Sunday night, to pick the stories we'd cover, frame how they were presented, and then deliver it all right from the chair that Peter Jennings once occupied. Whenever anyone asked me, I told them I had the best job on the planet, and I meant it. But, perversely, my good fortune meant I now had that much more to lose, and thus that much more to protect. And the competition all around had intensified. I'd been at the network for 5 years now, and the ranks of younger people had filled out dramatically. It wasn't just David Wright I had to watch out for. There was also Chris Cuomo, the charismatic, strapping son of the famous former governor of New York, who had replaced Robin Roberts on GMA, Bill Weir, the hilariously funny and wildly creative former local sports anchor who'd been named as co-host of the newly created weekend edition of GMA, and David Muir, the eminently likable, ferociously hardworking anchorman who had been lovingly profiled in Men's Vogue and was now helming the Saturday edition of World News. My relationships with these newer additions were great. They were friends. But that didn't change the fact that we were locked in a zero-sum competition for a scarce resource, airtime, specifically assignments to cover the big stories, as well as fill-in slots for when the A-list anchors were away. The mental loop, how many stories have I had on this week, etc., that began when I first arrived from local news, went into hyperdrive, only with an even more personal tinge. It was one thing back in the day to be big-footed by a veteran correspondent, but to be beat out by someone my own age, now that stung. Like almost all correspondents, every day I would check the rundowns for various shows, the computerized lists of stories the broadcast would be covering, to see who was doing which ones. If someone scored an assignment I wanted, I'd experience a brief rush of resentment. I'd collect data points. Weir gets to cover the election of the new pope, Muir is filling in for Cuomo, and immediately extrapolate to far-reaching conclusions. This means that X or Y executive or anchor dislikes me, my career is doomed, I'm going to end up in a flophouse in Duluth. Sometimes, before I'd even thought it through, I'd find myself on the phone with an executive producer of one of our broadcasts saying impolitic things. I would occasionally complain about all of this to Dr. Brotman, who applied his perfect shrinky mix of sympathy and skepticism. He had a competitive job, too, negotiating the executive ranks at his hospital, but often he thought I was blatantly overreacting to intramural developments at ABC. In fact, his theory was that just as I had used drugs to replace the thrill of combat, I was now inflating the drama of the office war zone to replace drugs. Maybe. I was conflicted. I was absolutely aware that worrying could be counterproductive. Furthermore, I did not enjoy harboring competitive feelings toward people I liked and admired. But I still firmly believe that a certain amount of churning was unavoidable, especially in this business, and I had no intention of abandoning the whole price of security thing. During this period, as I continued to deal with the aftermath of my panic attacks, my residual drug cravings, and the intensifying competitive pressures of work, it never once occurred to me that any aspect of the religious traditions I was reporting on could be relevant or useful to me personally. Faith was proving an increasingly interesting beat to cover for journalistic reasons, but it wasn't serving the same purpose for me as it did for all the believers I was meeting, answering my deepest questions, or speaking to my most profound needs. That said, I continue with my plan for broadening our coverage beyond the hot buttons of the culture wars. I went to Salt Lake City to profile the apostles of the Mormon Church. I interviewed the head of a Wiccan coven in Massachusetts. I even covered the annual American Atheists Convention. On Wanbo's urging, we launched a series called Tests of Faith, which included stories about a Unitarian congregation in California agonizing over whether to accept a registered sex offender, and also about an Episcopal priest who claimed that after a profound conversion experience, she now believed in both Christianity and Islam. I kept covering the born-again scene, of course. It was too juicy and too newsy to ignore. And with Ted Haggard, I now had a terrific inside source to make sure my coverage was more accurate and nuanced. He became my first stop when I was looking for candid answers about evangelicals. He was always willing to respond to questions off the record, returning emails instantaneously from his private AOL account. When Pat Robertson publicly suggested that the United States send covert agents to assassinate Venezuelan dictator Hugo Chavez, Ted was the only major evangelical figure to go on the record about it, saying, "Pat was not speaking for Christianity." I did the interview from an edit room at our offices in New York City, where I could see Ted on a monitor beamed in via satellite from Colorado. When it was over, we exchanged a few pleasantries, and Ted good-naturedly made fun of me for having worn an ugly green tie on television the night before. Not long afterward, he and his top lieutenant, a crisp young guy named Rob, came to New York, and I took them out to a fancy restaurant for lunch. Ted seemed impressed by the whole Manhattan scene. Over the gentle clinking of silverware and with a view of Central Park, he continued to pull back the curtain on the inner workings of American evangelicalism. He told me how he and Jim Dobson had clashed over Ted's desire to focus evangelicals on issues like global warming. In Ted's account, the behind-the-scenes maneuvering included behavior that was surprisingly ruthless. It was fun to talk to Ted. You might think that the yawning cultural and philosophical gap between us, he was a guy who believed that he had a running dialogue with Jesus after all, would make a genuine connection impossible, but that clearly was not the case. While I liked Ted, it was also pretty obvious that he had a dual agenda, to promote the faith and to promote himself. I was by no means the only reporter Ted was working. In fact, he played the media like a fiddle, doing interviews with Tom Brokaw and Barbara Walters, and all that exposure worked. Since we'd met, Ted had been elected head of the National Association of Evangelicals, which had 27 million members at 43,000 churches. Every Monday, he joined a conference call with the White House and other high-ranking Christians. Time put him on their list of the 25 most influential evangelicals. Sometimes he pushed his shtick a little too far. He made a memorably creepy cameo in an HBO documentary about the American faith scene, in which he said, seemingly off the cuff, "You know, all the surveys say the evangelicals have the best sex life of any other group." In one interview with me, after I'd asked him a series of questions about hot-button social issues, he stopped short in the middle of an answer. Then, while the cameras rolled, he said, "I hope I'm not coming across here as too harsh. Am I coming across as too harsh? I'm just going to focus on how cute Dan is, and then I won't seem so harsh." I had no idea how to deal with this comment other than to laugh and shift uncomfortably in my chair. Notwithstanding Ted's foibles, he had helped me become utterly at ease around people who said, "God bless you," when I hadn't sneezed. Increasingly, I now found myself in the position of defending evangelicals to my friends and family. Once, when I made a passing reference to evangelical intellectuals, a relative quipped, "Isn't that a contradiction in terms?" Another stereotype I spent a lot of time batting down, that Christians were all spittle-spewing hate-mongers. I met a few of these in my travels, of course, but they struck me as a distinct minority. Wanbo and I, two non-religious New Yorkers, one of them gay, the other gay-friendly, were never treated with anything short of respect. Often, in fact, what we found was kindness, hospitality, and curiosity. Yes, people would always ask whether we were believers, but when we said no, there were never gasps or glares. They may have thought we were going to hell, but they were perfectly nice about it. Then, early one November morning in 2006, I was groggily rooting around the internet looking for stories. I started each day with an email to the senior producers of World News, pitching pieces I could do for that night's show. And there it was on Drudge, an article saying that Ted Haggard had been accused by a male escort of paying for sex as well as for crystal meth. I immediately assumed it must be a mistake or a smear. I was so convinced it couldn't be true that I didn't even include it in my pitch email. A short while later, when one of the senior producers from Good Morning America called to ask me about it, I confidently assured her it must be false. But then the story took on real legs. The male escort, a beefy, incongruously soft-voiced man named Mike Jones, seemed pretty credible. He said he'd had repeated encounters with a man who called himself Art. In an interview with our ABC affiliate in Denver, Jones said, "It was not an emotional relationship, it was strictly for sex." He explained that this had gone on for years, but that when he saw Ted/Art on television backing a ballot initiative that would ban gay marriage, he decided he had to come forward. He's in the position of influence of millions of followers, and he's preaching against gay marriage, he said. But behind everyone's back, he's doing what he's preached against. Making matters worse for Ted, Jones had voicemails on which he claimed Ted could be heard arranging assignations and drug deals. On one of them, a male voice said, "Hi, Mike, this is Art, just calling to see if we can get any more supply." It was unmistakably Ted. I was thunderstruck. No one I knew had ever taken me by surprise quite like this. The clean-cut, Indiana-raised, God-fearing Ted Haggard, a father of five and the spiritual shepherd to thousands, had been leading a double life. I had been in contact with the guy for years and had never even the slightest inkling. In hindsight, there might have been a few signs that all of his lieutenants were young and male, that time he called me cute, but really, none of that would have foretold the panoramic collapse that was now playing out. The unmasking of Ted Haggard became a massive national story. There are few things the media loves more than a self-appointed paragon of virtue falling from grace. Local reporters captured Haggard leaving his house in an SUV with his wife by his side and several of his children in the car. To me, he looked like a child caught dead to rights, but still hoping against hope that he could talk his way out of it. He leaned over the wheel and told the assembled reporters, "I've never had a gay relationship with anybody, and I'm steady with my wife." "So you don't know Mike Jones?" one reporter asked. "No, I don't know Mike Jones," he said. Moments later, in a flagrant bit of bad acting, Ted asked, "What did you say his name was?" Days later, the charade crumbled. He stepped down from his positions at the National Association of Evangelicals and at New Life Church. In a statement read aloud to his followers, he said, "There is a part of my life that is so repulsive and dark that I've been warring against it all of my adult life." The affair gave birth to 1,000 snarky blog posts, and it confirmed Americans' lowest opinions about evangelicals. This was, after all, a man who described homosexuality as a sin, as a life that is against God. My gay friends were eating it up, Wanbo being one notable exception. He never once crowed. Like me, he seemed surprised and a little saddened. We both agreed that while Ted was clearly guilty of towering hypocrisy, there was also some poignancy to the fact that the moral teachings associated with his faith had forced him to suppress a fundamental part of who he was. We covered the story aggressively, but also took pains to point out that Haggard was much less strident than many of his co-religionists on the issue of homosexuality. In fact, he had once assured Barbara Walters in a primetime interview that gays, too, can go to heaven. Throughout the crisis, I'd been calling and emailing Ted repeatedly. No reply. The guy who used to get back to me within seconds had gone completely dark. After a few days, the story died down, as it always does. America, as then-Senator Barack Obama had noted after Hurricane Katrina, goes from shock to trance faster than any other nation on Earth. As Ted's world fell apart, mine was getting much better. Just weeks later, Bob Woodruff told me he wanted to set me up on a date. Not 2 years after surviving a bomb blast to the head in Iraq, Woody, as he was known to his friends, was playing matchmaker. At first, I was skeptical. I was not enthusiastic about being set up. To me, it seemed slightly pathetic. But it was hard to say no to an American hero, a guy whose story was turned into a best-selling book, and who was greeted by Jon Stewart during an appearance on The Daily Show with the question, "Why are you still more handsome than me?" Bob's wife, Lee, an effervescent and hilarious blonde, was hard to refuse as well. Here's how she laid out the whole setup situation. Her name is Bianca, she's beautiful, she's a doctor, and you're an idiot if you don't do this. This Bianca was, per Bob and Lee, an internal medicine resident at Columbia University. The Woodruffs were friends with her parents, and what could I do? I said yes. On the night prearranged for the date, I was walking out of the gym on my way to the restaurant when my phone rang. It was Bob calling to make sure I wasn't flaking out. "Dude," he assured me, "she's hot." We were meeting at an Italian spot on the Upper West Side. Pathologically punctual, I showed up early and staked out a spot at the bar near a pair of bankers from New Jersey doing shots. It was mid-December and the place had festive decorations and a holiday feel. My plan was to lean against the bar, staring at my BlackBerry, so that when Bianca walked in, she could come over and tap me on the shoulder, and I could look up all cool and nonchalant. Of course, I was too nervous to pull that off and ended up staring anxiously at the door. Minutes later, when she appeared, my internal reaction was similar to the one my cousin Andy described the first time he met his future wife. "I'll take this one." Bob had not exaggerated. She was beautiful, with golden hair and piercing light blue eyes like a husky's but much softer. As I did whenever I was confronted with anyone I found intriguing, I peppered her with biographical questions. She was raised in Manhattan. Her dad was a doctor, her mom an artist. She was 6 months out of medical school and in the hellishly stressful first year of residency. She was also, as I learned over the course of the evening, smart, passionate about medicine, humble, optimistic, quick to laugh, and a lover of animals and dessert. Pretty soon, we were doing tequila shots with the bankers. Drinks turned into dinner. The first date turned into a second. 3 months later, Bianca moved into my apartment. On the day we brought her stuff over, I marveled at the affable yet unyielding diplomatic skills she employed to convince me to give up 60% of my closet space. 2 months after that, we adopted cats. When we called my parents to ask them to provide a character reference for the assiduous pet vetters at the ASPCA, my father, who aside from being a worrier is also a wise ass, asked whether we were also going to have a commitment ceremony. The cats immediately became the butt of jokes among my male friends at work, who automatically associated felinity with femininity, ignoring historical cat-loving avatars of machismo such as Ernest Hemingway, Winston Churchill, and Dr. Evil. When Chris Cuomo heard about our pet adoptions, he sent me an email that read, "Do you sit when you pee?" As a man who was a mild hypochondriac, it was handy to have a doctor around. More significantly, after living alone in my apartment for nearly a decade, I found it wonderfully strange to get back into bed after a middle-of-the-night trip to the bathroom and see three cats and a human form lying there, all of whom now had equal claim to the territory. Bianca truly brought out the fool in me. I had never been this comfortable around anyone before. I would march around the apartment, a displeased feline under each arm, singing songs. I would make up ridiculous nicknames for them. When she was in the living room trying to work, I'd use the remote app on my iPad to blast Steppenwolf and lie there with a stupid, twisted-up grin as she burst into the room, tut-tutting about the interruption. I was beguiled by the contrasts. This was a woman who subscribed to the New England Journal of Medicine and also Us Weekly. She looked great in both scrubs and cocktail dresses. She could work a 30-hour shift, during which she would perform chest compressions, manage ornery colleagues, and comfort grieving families, then come home, take a nap, and cook her grandmother's sauce and meatballs. When I went away on work trips, I often arrived at my destination to find that she had packed snacks and a mash note in my suitcase. I'd never been in love before. I'd had a nagging fear that maybe I was too self-centered to ever get there. Everyone always said you'd know, but I never knew. Now, all of a sudden, I did. It was a huge relief to sincerely want what was best for Bianca, to worry about her life and her career rather than just fixate inwardly. Selfishly, I felt she was both a smarter and kinder person than I was, and that being by her side might make me better. Sorting out my romantic life after decades of often aimless bachelorhood was like scratching a huge existential itch. On the downside, though, it left me free to concentrate all of my neurotic powers on work. Bianca pointed out that I would sometimes come through the door at night scowling. "What's wrong?" she'd ask. "Nothing," I'd mutter, then make a beeline for the couch, turn on the television, and launch into a harsh post-game analysis of my latest story. It was hard for her not to take my occasional gruffness a little personally. More than that, she hated seeing me gloomy. She had a doctor's urge to cure and a sense of sadness and frustration that she couldn't. It was not as if she didn't understand and sympathize with the price of security stance. This was a woman who had graduated at the top of her med school class, was in an elite residency program, and who still felt she had more to prove than anyone else. She, too, would come home frayed, but fairly or unfairly, the very nature of Bianca's anxiety would make me feel superficial by comparison. She would cry over her patient's pain or loss, whereas my complaints often involved a colleague getting a story I wanted or questions about whether I'd handled myself well during a contentious on-air interview. From Bianca's point of view, though, perhaps the most annoying part of my work fixation was my unnatural attachment to my BlackBerry, which I kept within reach during dinner, on the couch as we watched TV, and on my bedside table all during the night. She'd catch me glancing at it in the middle of conversations and shoot me a j'accuse look. She did eventually convince me to at least move the offending instrument and its charger to the other side of the bedroom while we slept. One of the things I was often doing with that BlackBerry was sending emails to Ted Haggard. I'd hit him up every month or so, desperately seeking that exclusive interview whenever he emerged from seclusion. Journalism aside, I was also massively curious about where he was and what he was doing. Nearly a year went by before he wrote me back. When at last I got him on the phone, he had an incredible story to tell. Time's 11th most influential American evangelical was now living with his family in a dingy apartment in Arizona, barely scraping by, selling insurance. Remarkably, his wife, Gail, had decided to stand by him. Several months later, on a frigid January morning in New York City, Ted and I sat down for his first network news interview since the scandal. I was nervous, and it showed. I have a very obvious tell when I'm anxious. My face looks tired, and on this day I looked exhausted. I tried jumping up and down, slapping my cheeks, and standing out in the cold, but I couldn't fix it. I was simply uncomfortable doing what was sure to be a tough interview with someone I knew and liked. For the shoot, Wanbo had rented a studio downtown, and I was sitting in a cushioned chair opposite Ted, who was on a couch. Unlike me, he seemed entirely at ease with the inquisition that was to ensue. He was leaning back, legs crossed, wearing a blazer but no tie. I dove right in. "Is it fair to describe you as a hypocrite and a liar?" I asked. Yes, it is," he said, almost enthusiastically, as if he couldn't wait to get it off his chest. "Do you owe gay people an apology?" I asked. "Absolutely, and I do apologize," he said. "I'm deeply sorry for the attitude I had, but I think I was partially so vehement because of my own war." Amazingly to me, he insisted he wasn't gay. Months of psychotherapy, he said, had cleared everything up. "Now I'm settled in the fact that I am a heterosexual, but with issues," he said, "so I don't fit into a neat little box." He said it was no problem to stay faithful to his wife. "It's not a struggle at all now." "Why not just live as a gay man?" I asked. "'Cause I love my wife. I love my intimate relationship with my wife. I'm not gay." Can you hear people watching this, though, and thinking to themselves, this guy is just not being honest with himself? Sure, but everybody has their own journey, and people can judge me. I think it's fair if they judge me and that they think I'm not being real with myself. The toughest moment in the interview came when I surprised him by playing him a damning piece of videotape we'd obtained. It was an interview with a former parishioner, a young man who said he'd been sexually harassed by Ted. On the tape, he described, in graphic terms, how one night Ted had hopped into bed with him in a hotel room and began to masturbate. When the video ended, Ted said, "It is true. We never had any sexual contact, but I violated that relationship and it was an inappropriate relationship." "What's it like to watch that?" I asked. "It's embarrassing. That was very embarrassing. I mean, I'm a failure." When it was all over, Ted didn't seem at all resentful that I'd blindsided him. I had coffee with him and his wife, and we chatted as if none of it had ever happened. We talked a lot about what Ted's next move might be. The one thing he swore he'd never do again was pastor a church. A couple of months later, he asked me to meet him and Gail for lunch at a Midtown hotel because they wanted advice on how to pitch a reality show they were dreaming up. When that didn't take off, they started a church. What struck me most from the interview was not Ted's slipperiness or his eyebrow-raising claims about the nature of sexuality or even his wife's decision not to file for divorce. It was something else. For all of Ted's hypocrisy and deception, there was one issue on which he did not waver: his faith. "I never fell away from God," he told me. When I pointed out that it was his religious beliefs that forced him to live a lie for so many years, he countered that it was the culture of hatefulness in the modern church that did that, not the core teachings of Jesus himself. In his darkest moments, when he was living in that apartment in Arizona, crying every day for a year and a half and actively contemplating suicide, his faith was his main source of comfort. It gave him the sense that his travails were part of a larger plan, that even if everyone on earth hated him, his creator did not. "I knew with assurance," he said, "that God cared for me." In the weeks and months after the interview, I kept coming back to this. I, too, had endured my own self-created crisis, albeit of a less public and less intense variety. Ted's involved doing drugs and cheating on his wife. Mine involved doing drugs and having a nationally televised freakout. On this score, I envied Ted, and not in a patronizing, "I wish I were stupid enough to believe this stuff" way. It would have been enormously helpful to have had a sense that my troubles had a larger purpose or fit into some overarching plan. I had read the research showing that regular churchgoers tended to be happier, in part because having a sense that the world is infused with meaning and that suffering happens for a reason helped them deal more successfully with life's inevitable humiliations. Up until my interview with Ted, I had derived a smug sense of self-satisfaction that, unlike the believers I was covering, I did not have a deep need for answers to the big questions. I was comfortable with the mystery of how we got here and what would happen after we died. But I now realized that a sort of incuriosity had set in. My sense of awe had atrophied. I might have disagreed with the conclusions reached by people of faith, but at least that part of their brain was functioning. Every week they had a set time to consider their place in the universe, to step out of the matrix and achieve some perspective. If you're never looking up, I now realized, you're always just looking around. Ted Haggard, who had taught me to see people of faith in a different light, had also taught me something else: the value of a viewpoint that transcended the mundane. Of course, I wasn't forsaking ambition, and I wasn't planning to magically force myself to believe in something for which there was, in my opinion, insufficient evidence. However, I was about to cover a story that, for the first time since Peter Jennings ordered me to start reporting on spirituality, would actually penetrate my defenses. The message came in a deeply weird and extremely confusing package. Chapter 3: Genius or Lunatic? The man sitting across from me and completely blowing my mind favored a style, both verbal and sartorial, so monochrome that it was as if he wanted to vanish like a chameleon into the barf-colored wallpaper of this hotel room in Toronto. He was elfin, roomy-eyed, and, as the cameras rolled, droning on in a gentle Teutonic lilt. Superficially, at least, he was the type of person who, if you met him at a cocktail party, you would either ignore or avoid. And yet, he was saying extraordinary things, life-altering things. He was making points that were forcing me to rethink my whole price of security modus operandi. Not just rethink it, but think above it, beyond it and possibly go beyond thought altogether. The real mindfuck, though, was this. Almost as soon as he said something brilliant, he would say something else that was totally ridiculous. The man was toggling seamlessly between compelling and confusing, incisive and insane. He would go like this, zig, a spot-on diagnosis of the human condition. Zag, a bizarre pseudoscientific assertion. Zig, a profound insight into how we make ourselves miserable. Zag, a claim that he once lived on park benches for 2 years in a state of bliss. He said he had a way for me to be happier too, and despite the fog of falderol, I half suspected he might actually be right. Weeks before I first heard the name Eckhart Tolle, I was staring, unhappily, in the mirror of an airplane bathroom. I was on my way home from shooting a Nightline story in Brazil, where we'd spent a week living with an isolated Amazon tribe. It had been amazing. These people still lived exactly as their ancestors had in the Stone Age. They'd barely met any outsiders. They let my producer and me sleep in hammocks in their huts. I returned the favor by entertaining them with my video iPod. Leaning over the metallic counter in this lavatory, I was neither savoring the incredible experience I had just had, nor strategizing about how to write my story, which was set to air a few weeks hence. Instead, I had my forelock pushed back and was scrutinizing a hairline that seemed to me about as stable as the Maginot line. Bianca had busted me doing this on more than one occasion in our bathroom at home. She pointed out that other than some thinning in the back and a receding divot near my part, I basically had a full head of hair. But every now and again, a stray glance in a reflective surface would send me down the rabbit hole. Here in this cramped airplane bathroom, I was flashing on a future that looked like this. Baldness, unemployment, flophouse in Duluth. Inevitably, this led to a nasty rejoinder from some other, more reasonable part of my brain. Get over yourself, Harris. When I brought this hair thing up with Dr. Brotman, he leaned back in his chair and beamed skepticism at me from across his desk. You don't understand, I told him. If I go bald, my career is screwed. You don't understand, he replied, eyeing my hairline. You're not going bald. By any rational measure, things were otherwise going extremely well in my life. Nearly 3 years had passed since my panic attacks. I was off the Klonopin and down to seeing Brotman only once a month or so. Occasionally, I'd be ambushed by waves of longing for drugs, but the cravings were vastly diminished. Although I tried to keep in mind something a friend had once told me. Your demons may have been ejected from the building, but they're out in the parking lot doing push-ups. At home, the situation was even better. After living together for more than a year, Bianca and I had gotten engaged and were planning a wedding in the Bahamas. At work, my gig anchoring the Sunday edition of World News continued to be a joy. And even though public interest in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan was on the wane, a new opportunity had emerged. The post-Koppel Nightline had moved away from live interviews and more toward lengthy taped stories from all over the world. The producers had allowed me to launch major investigations, such as tracking rhino poachers in Nepal and posing as a customer in order to expose child slave traders in Haiti. This was a new type of reporting for me. It had a crusading spirit. Corny or not, I found that old journalistic injunction to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable inspiring. Nevertheless, my worrying over work had grown worse, and the hair issue was just the leading indicator. Increasingly, I was waking up to the fact that the whole industry rested on such an uncertain foundation. In my 8 years at the network, I had witnessed seemingly immovable fixtures of broadcast news fade or simply disappear. Among the missing were Peter Jennings, Tom Brokaw, and Dan Rather. When I had arrived at ABC News back in 2000, I was the youngest correspondent on the fourth floor. Suddenly, at age 37, I was nearly the oldest. All but one of those more senior correspondents had departed, often unceremoniously. These were guys who had given their lives to a profession that could be lavishly kind or capriciously cruel. I'd seen so many careers soar or sour based on seemingly random things, such as changing physical appearance, the personal whim of a specific anchor or executive, or the emergence of a more eye-catching rival. In discussing the unpredictability of my profession with my brother recently, he told me about scientific studies where lab rats were rewarded with food pellets at random, illogical times. Those rats went crazy. To make matters worse, the country was in the most severe recession since the Great Depression. Bear Stearns had just collapsed, along with Lehman Brothers. The stock market was in free fall. It felt like the world had gone off a cliff no one had seen coming. ABC News went through a wrenching round of layoffs. While my job seemed safe at the moment, I felt bad for my colleagues and fretted about the future. When I thought about alternative careers, I drew a blank. What other marketable skills did I have besides wearing makeup and bellowing into cameras? This was a bit maudlin, but there were a few times when I found myself lying on the couch in my office, staring at a picture on my wall of the ocean, thinking about the word impermanence. On one such occasion, there was a knock on my door. It was David Muir popping by to chat. We had a lot in common. We'd both worked in local news in Boston, arrived at the network before the age of 30, and loved to travel the planet doing stories. Just a couple of months earlier, David had filed some amazing reports from Chernobyl. He had the office down the hall from me, and we'd sometimes get together to talk about our latest stories or just gossip. In the spirit of misery looking for company, I asked him what he would do if the whole TV news business imploded. He shrugged his shoulders with enviable insouciance and said, I'd find something else. Back in the toilet on the airplane coming home from Brazil, I replayed that scene in my mind as I continued to stare at my faltering hairline. Easy for you to say, Muir, with your full head of hair. I'd been in this position in front of the mirror for at least 10 minutes. I realized, with a twinge of embarrassment, that there was probably a line outside by now. I let my hair fall back down onto my forehead and returned, sheepishly, to my seat. About a month or so later, on a sunny Saturday in September, I was at a block party in New Jersey. There was a cookout, a bounce castle for the kids, and a band with a bassist wearing a do-rag. When the music stopped, a pastor took the mic and declared, with his voice echoing off the brightly colored vinyl siding of the surrounding row houses, "There's room for everyone at the cross today." I was here for a story about Sarah Palin, recently plucked from obscurity to become John McCain's running mate. A video had just hit the web showing Palin praying for God's help to get a gas pipeline built in her home state of Alaska. That had sparked a lot of discussion about the fact that she was a Pentecostal, a strain of Christianity sometimes described as evangelicalism on steroids. I wanted to do a piece that would explain to viewers exactly what Pentecostals believed. The closest church was here in Jersey City, and they just happened to be throwing a party. To be away from the noise, our cameraman, soundman, and producer had set up for the interviews a little farther down the street. The three of them were in the middle of an animated discussion led by Felicia, the producer, a petite, apple-cheeked mother of two with whom I'd worked for many years. She was telling the others about a book she'd just read by someone named Eckhart Tolle. As I approached, she turned toward me. "Have you read him? You might like him. It's all about controlling your ego." The crew burst out laughing. Like me, they took it as a joke about the anchorman's inevitably inflated sense of self-importance. Felicia, earnest and unfailingly polite, flushed and, speaking rapidly now, assured us that she wasn't making a joke. Her point was that she had read Tolle's books and found them personally useful. More than that, Oprah had been heavily promoting his latest volume, and she thought Tolle might make a good story. Fair enough, I was always looking for stories, and this one, featuring an Oprah-approved self-help swami, sounded like it might include the requisite exotica. So when I got home later that day, I went online and ordered the book. By the time his book arrived at my apartment a few days later, I'd almost forgotten about Eckhart Tolle. I saw the cheesy orange cover shining dully through Amazon's irrationally excessive bubble wrap. It bore the rather overwrought title, "A New Earth: Awakening to Your Life's Purpose," as well as the seal of Oprah's book club. I propped it on my chest that night, and unsuspecting Bianca sleeping to my left, blissfully unaware that her future husband was being sucked into a strange vortex. At first, the book struck me as irredeemable poppycock. I was put off by the strained stateliness of Tolle's writing, as well as its nearly indecipherable turgidity. How could Oprah fans stand to drink from a fire hose of jargon like conditioned mind structures and the one indwelling consciousness? What's more, the guy was stunningly grandiose. He referred to his book as a transformational device and promised that as you read, a shift takes place within you. I lay there, rolling my eyes, quietly cursing Felicia for inflicting this upon me. But just when I thought I'd been defeated by all the porridge about inner opening and the impending shift in planetary consciousness, a clearing appeared in the spiritual thicket. Tolle began to unfurl a fascinating thesis, one that made me think he must have somehow spent an enormous amount of time inside my skull. Our entire lives, he argued, are governed by a voice in our heads. This voice is engaged in a ceaseless stream of thinking, most of it negative, repetitive, and self-referential. It squawks away at us from the minute we open our eyes in the morning until the minute we fall asleep at night, if it allows us to sleep at all. Talk, talk, talk. This voice is constantly judging and labeling everything in its field of vision. Its targets aren't just external, it often viciously taunts us, too. Apparently, Felicia was right when she got all flustered on that little street in Jersey City. Tolle wasn't using the term ego the way most of us normally do. He wasn't referring simply to pride, conceit, or amour propre of the variety often displayed by people who appear on television for a living. Nor was he using it in the Freudian sense as the psychological mechanism that mediates between our id and our superego, our desires and our morality. He meant something much larger. According to Tolle, the ego is our inner narrator, our sense of I. Certainly, Tolle had described my mind to a T. While I'd never really thought about it before, I suppose I'd always assumed that the voice in my head was me, my ghostly internal anchorman hosting the coverage of my life, engaged in an unsolicited stream of insensitive questions and obnoxious color commentary. Per Tolle, even though the voice is the ridgepole of our interior lives, most of us take it completely for granted. He argued that the failure to recognize thoughts for what they are, quantum bursts of psychic energy that exist solely in your head, is the primordial human error. When we are unaware of the egoic mind, egoic being a word he appears to have invented, we blindly act out our thoughts, and often the results are not pretty. I began to recall some of the many brilliant suggestions the voice in my head had made to me over the years. You should do cocaine. You're right to be angry at that producer. Throw your papers in the air. That Pakistani protester is way out of line. Even though he's surrounded by 1,000 angry friends, you should have a shouting match with him. I'd been reading for an hour now and totally had my full attention. As I turned the pages, he began to list some of the ego's signature moves, many of which seemed to be grabbed directly from my behavioral repertoire. The ego is never satisfied. No matter how much stuff we buy, no matter how many arguments we win or delicious meals we consume, the ego never feels complete. Did this not describe my bottomless appetite for airtime or drugs? Is this what my friend Simon meant when he said I had the soul of a junkie? Sometimes, in the course of a single sentence, he would say something lucid and compelling and then veer straight into crazy town. I honestly could not figure out if he was a genius or a lunatic. Then I learned more about who this guy actually was. After several nights of reading his book well into the wee hours, I padded over to the computer to do a little Googling. I don't know what I was expecting, but certainly not this, a small, sandy-haired German man who appeared to be at some indeterminate point north of middle age. His presentation style was totally at odds with the voice of God tone he affected on the page. In YouTube videos, he spoke softly and slowly, excruciatingly so, as if someone had forced him to ingest a large dose of my leftover Klonopin. His wardrobe appeared to consist solely of sweater vests and pleated khakis. One observer described him as looking like a communist-era librarian. Another called him a pale, kindly otter. The seminal event of his personal history was an experience he claimed to have had as a severely depressed graduate student at Oxford University. He said he was lying in his bed when he was overcome with suicidal thoughts. Suddenly, he felt himself being sucked into a void. He heard a voice telling him to resist nothing. Then everything went dark. He woke up the next morning and the birds were chirping, the sunlight was a revelation, and his life was a shiny, sparkly thing. It was, quite literally, an overnight panacea. Bingo, done, sorted. After that is when he spent 2 years living on park benches in a state of the most intense joy. This was his spiritual awakening, of which he would later say, "The realization of peace is so deep that even if I met the Buddha and the Buddha said, 'You are wrong,' I would say, 'Oh, isn't that interesting? Even the Buddha can be wrong.'" Eventually, he moved to Canada, which had the right energy field for his first book to be born. That book, The Power of Now, became a celebrity sensation. Meg Ryan gave it to Oprah, who put copies on the nightstands in the guest rooms of all of her homes. Jim Carrey and Jenny McCarthy produced videotaped testimonials before they broke up. Paris Hilton carried the book through a gauntlet of paparazzi on her way into jail over a driving violation. When his follow-up, A New Earth, came out, Oprah put on an unprecedented 11-part webinar. Millions of people tuned in to watch her and Tolle sit at a desk deconstructing the book chapter by chapter. Their personal styles were almost comically mismatched. Oprah would whoop and holler as Tolle looked on placidly. Tolle would prattle on about energy fields as Oprah mmmed and ahed credulously. At one point, she threw up her arms for a double high five, and Tolle, clearly not knowing what such a thing was, awkwardly clasped her hands. Sitting there in my underwear in front of my computer in the middle of the night, I put my head in my hands. My whole life, I'd prided myself on being a skeptic. I'd spent nearly a decade interviewing spiritual leaders, and none of them penetrated my defenses. Now, this guy, who looked like a character from The Hobbit, was the one who had punched through? I was looking in the mirror again, this time at an angry red hole the size of a quarter, smack in the middle of my right cheek. When the dermatologist first discovered the milky patch on my cheek, basal cell carcinoma, a non-lethal form of skin cancer, I was tempted to just leave it there. Face surgery was an unappetizing prospect for a guy who went on TV for a living. The doctor, however, along with Bianca, argued that inaction was not an option. If I let it spread unchecked, they told me, it could get into my eye socket and blind me. For a nanosecond, I considered whether I might prefer partial blindness to a scar, even though the doctor promised that if everything went well, said scar would be a small one. The surgery was Chinese water torture. The surgeon, a crisp young woman, made an initial incision using a microscopically guided scalpel to remove the cancer. After that first stab, she sent me out to the waiting room as she ran some tests to see if she'd gotten it all. I joined Bianca at a bank of chairs where I pulled out my copy of A New Earth, which I was now reading for the third time. After a half hour or so, the doctor called me back and said they needed to dig a little deeper. So I went under the knife again and then back to the waiting room where I read more of the book. Another half hour passed, and then the nurse came back and told me they still hadn't gotten every last teeny bit. They'd need to take a wider slice. When I arrived back in the procedure room this time, the doctor explained that the cancer was bigger than she had thought, and she still didn't know how big. I pressed her for worst-case scenarios, and she admitted that there was a danger that it might have spread into the lower part of my eyelid. If that were true, closing the wound would involve a scar that permanently pulled down my right eye. I could feel my heartbeat accelerate as the following movie instantly played out in my mind. Scar, the size of Omar Little's from The Wire, fired from ABC News, seeks career in radio. But then a funny thing happened. After all my reading about the empty nattering of the ego, I realized these fearful forecasts were just thoughts skittering through my head. They weren't irrational, but they weren't necessarily true. It was a momentary glimpse of the wisdom of Tolle's thesis. It's not like I'd never been aware of my thoughts before. I'd had plenty of experience with being scared and knowing I was scared. What made this different was that I was able to see my thoughts for what they were, just thoughts with no concrete reality. It's not that my worry suddenly ceased, I just wasn't as taken in by it. I recognized the truth of this situation. I had no idea what was going to happen to my face, and reflexively believing the worst-case scenarios coughed up by my ego certainly wasn't going to help. The doctor made her third slice and sent me back into the waiting room. Bianca remarked that I was staying surprisingly calm. I didn't want to give the credit to Tolly, lest she think I was going crazy. She already thought it was weird that I'd been reading this book for so long. Ultimately, I had to go back in for 4 facial slices before the tumor was fully removed. They came within a millimeter, but the lower part of my eyelid was spared. Before they sewed me up, the doctor showed me the wound in a mirror and I nearly fainted. I could see well into the side of my cheek, blood, fat, and all. Bianca took out her phone and snapped a picture. I had done surprisingly well in the crucible of face surgery, but you can't carry an Eckhart Tolle book around with you everywhere you go. A couple of weeks later, I was checking TV Newser, an addictive website that tracks the doings of the broadcast news industry, and I came across a list of the anchors and correspondents who will be covering the inauguration of President Barack Obama. My name was not mentioned. I was, to put it mildly, displeased. Unlike my experience with the surgery, here I was unable to achieve any distance from the angry thoughts caroming through my head. Instead, I took the bait dangled by my ego, which was yammering on in high dudgeon, "You're getting screwed here, dude." I shoved back my chair and started pacing around my office in tight circles like a chihuahua doing dressage. Over the next 24 hours, I buttonholed every executive I could find and voiced my complaints. Instead of winning me a role in the coverage, however, this whining earned me a reprimand. One of my bosses took me aside and told me that the decision wasn't personal and then advised me to stop bleeding all over the place. This was my major beef with Tolle. Setting aside my qualms about his flowery writing, questionable claims, and bizarre backstory, what I truly could not abide was the lack of practical advice for handling situations like this. He delivered an extraordinary diagnosis of the human condition with basically no action plan for combating the ego, never mind for achieving living on a park bench super bliss. How do we do a better job of staying in the now? Tolle's answer, always say yes to the present moment. How do we achieve liberation from the voice in the head? His advice, simply be aware of it. To become free of the ego is not really a big job, but a very small one. Yes, right, easy. But if it were this uncomplicated, wouldn't there be millions of awakened people walking around? Then there was an even larger question. Even if I had been able to recognize that my umbrage over not being included in inauguration coverage consisted of mere thoughts, should I have simply ignored them? I could see the value of recognizing thoughts for what they are, fleeting, gossamer, unsubstantial. But aren't some thoughts connected to concrete realities that need to be addressed? In his books, Tolle repeatedly denigrated the habit of worrying, which he characterized as a useless process of projecting fearfully into an imaginary future. There is no way you can cope with such a situation because it doesn't exist. It's a mental phantom, he wrote. But while I understood the benefit of being in the now, the future was coming. Didn't I have to prepare? If I didn't think through every permutation of every potential problem, how the hell would I survive in a competitive industry? Furthermore, wasn't the restless ego the source of mankind's proudest achievements? Sure, it was probably responsible for ills such as war, child abuse, and Pauly Shore movies, but hadn't human striving also given us the polio vaccine, Caravaggio's paintings, and the iPhone? And yet, I was aware, of course, that my chattering mind was not entirely working in my favor. I was pretty sure that staring at my hairline or brooding on my couch was not time well spent. I used to think pressing the bruise kept me on my toes. Now I realize those moments mostly just made me unhappy. Tolle was forcing me to confront the fact that the thing I'd always thought was my greatest asset, my internal cattle prod, was also perhaps my greatest liability. I was now genuinely questioning my own personal orthodoxy, my price of security mantra, which had been my operating thesis since like age 8. All of a sudden, I didn't know, was it propulsive or corrosive? I wanted to excel, yes, but I also wanted to be less stressed in the process. This strange little German man seemed to raise the tantalizing possibility of doing both, but the books were not at all explicit about how to do so, at least not in a way that I understood. So I decided I needed to meet this guy. I ran into Felicia in the hallway at work. "Let's book Eckhart Tolle for an interview," I said. "We could do it as a Sunday profile," a weekly feature we'd recently decided to launch. It was as if I told her that she'd hit the Powerball or been chosen for beatification. She was beaming. Unlike me, she did not harbor suspicions that Tolle might be a fruitcake. She was all in. A couple of days later, she reported back that Tolle, who apparently rarely granted interviews, had said yes. He'd be in Toronto in a few weeks giving a sold-out speech, and we'd been granted a one-hour audience. They're being really strict about the time limit, she said, but she was still giddy. I flew in from New York on the morning of the interview. When I arrived at the hotel room where we'd be shooting, Felicia was there with the camera crew and a clean-cut young Australian guy named Anthony, who appeared to be Tolle's right-hand man. I'd expected a larger staff, but it was just this one guy. As we awaited the arrival of the great man, Anthony told me his story. He'd read some of Tolle's books, called him up, and asked for a job. When Tolle said yes, Anthony packed all his stuff and moved from Australia to Vancouver, where Tolle lived. Anthony struck me as reasonably normal with his neatly gelled blonde hair and pressed shirt. He discussed his boss with genuine admiration, but not adulation. Nothing in his bearing screamed cult to me. Shortly thereafter, there was a knock on the door, and Tolle entered. The first thing I noticed was that he was small, smaller than me, and I'm about 5'8" on days when I've used Bianca's volumizing shampoo. No entourage, just him. He had none of the swagger of a man who'd sold tens of millions of books and had a one-man industry of speaking gigs, CDs, and inspiration cards. He walked up and introduced himself with a handshake. He was unassuming, but not shy, not unfriendly, but not especially warm. Just as he had on Oprah's webinar, he seemed pleased to be there, but not particularly eager. He was wearing an astoundingly bland brown blazer over a tan sweater and a pale blue dress shirt. He had a scraggly beard that covered just his chin and neck. After the exchange of pleasantries, we took our seats for the interview. There were two cameras, one trained on Tolle, the other on me. I was mildly self-conscious about my mottled cheek, but mostly I was just excited. Here I was, finally face to face with the man who had come out of nowhere and so thoroughly intrigued and confused me. This was the first interview since I'd started covering spirituality where I actually felt like I had some skin in the game. "How on earth do you stop thinking?" I began. "How do you stop the voice in your head?" I had a momentary surge of optimism as he shifted in his chair in clear preparation to give the practical advice I'd been yearning for. "You create little spaces in your daily life where you are aware but not thinking," he said. "For example, you take one conscious breath." "Unbreak my heart, Eckhart. That's all you've got?" "But," I said, "I can hear the cynics in the audience saying, 'This guy's saying I can awaken by taking a deep breath. What's he talking about?'" "Yes, that's the mind talking. Of course, many people will have their mind commenting on what I'm saying and saying that is useless." In fact, that was exactly what my mind was saying. That is useless. My mind started saying things that were even less charitable as he rolled out his second allegedly practical suggestion. "Another very powerful thing to do is to become aware of the inner energy field of your being." Aware that I had a camera aimed at me, I hammed it up, again using that old journalistic trick of channeling a third-party cynic who could really be no one other than me. Energy field. Those are two words that, when put together, will fire off cynics' antennae very, very quickly. "Yes, now those are people who are very much in their mind, so they are not even willing to try out something new." I mentioned that my efforts to stay in the now had been frustrating, adding another layer of guilt on top of the normal churn of my mind. "Because I'm thinking all the time," I said, "I can't be in touch with the now, so now I'm feeling guilty about not being in touch with the now." "Yes, as you rightly put it, that's another layer of thinking, and that layer of thinking says, 'You see, it doesn't work, I can't be free of thinking,' which is more thinking," he said, laughing gently. "So how do you break out of that?" "You simply observe that it's another thought, and by knowing that it's another thought, you're not totally identified with the thought." This made my head hurt. Clearly, this line of questioning was going nowhere. Keenly aware that Tolle's assistant Anthony had his eye on the clock, I decided to move on. Which is when we came to the part of the interview where Tolle made what I considered to be his most ludicrous claim yet. "Don't you ever get pissed off, annoyed, irritated, sad, anything negative?" "No, I accept what is, And that's why life has become so simple. Well, what if somebody cuts you off in your car? It's fine. It's like a sudden gust of wind. I don't personalize a gust of wind, and so it's simply what is. And you're able to enjoy every moment, even if I start asking you a ton of annoying questions? Yes, that would be fine. Don't tempt me. Here he let out a real laugh from the diaphragm, leaning forward in his chair, eyes almost closed. He recovered and picked right up. It's becoming friendly just with the isness of this moment. The isness of this moment? Who is this guy kidding? Was he really saying that he was never in a bad mood, that nothing ever bothered him? How could he sit there on camera and claim that? It sounded great, of course, but so did learning how to fly. I don't fully understand that because I sometimes think about change, either innovation or social activism, like that little bit of sand in an oyster that creates a pearl. Yes, well, is it a clam or an oyster? I can't remember. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. Laughing again, he continued, the most powerful change comes actually out of that different state of consciousness. This is why people so admire what Gandhi did, because he was bringing about change from a state of consciousness that was already at peace. And people sometimes believe that if you're already at peace, you're never going to do anything. But that's not the case. Very powerful actions come out of that. So you're not saying sit around, let everything wash over you, let people cut you off in your car. You're saying understand that it is what it is right now, and then do what you need to do, he said, interrupting me this time and speaking with uncharacteristic brio. Make the present moment your friend rather than your enemy, because many people live habitually as if the present moment were an obstacle that they need to overcome in order to get to the next moment. And imagine living your whole life like that, where always this moment is never quite right, not good enough, because you need to get to the next one. That is continuous stress. Okay, now this made a ton of sense to me. For example, in the case of inauguration coverage, I could have accepted that my exclusion was already a reality and then simply had a series of calm conversations with my bosses about whether it was possible to change things instead of firing off a spray of foot bullets. Sitting with Tolle was like watching the movie version of his books, both in person and on the page. He moved with total ease between tremendously useful insights and head-scratching, grandiose claims about perfect imperturbability. By this point, the interview had run long. Felicia was visibly anxious. She apologetically explained to Tolle and Anthony that we really needed a walking shot, a picture of me and Tolle walking down the street or something. Everyone agreed this request could be accommodated. We took the elevator down to the lobby, where I chatted with Tolle while Felicia and the crew went outside to find a suitable spot for the shot. Sometimes after an interview, people are warmer. They're relieved it's over, and they feel they've gotten to know the interviewer a bit. Tolle's affect, however, was utterly unchanged. He exuded the same pleasant unflappability. Making small talk, I asked him his age, and he told me he was 62. When I remarked that he looked much younger than that, he told me matter-of-factly that he basically hadn't aged since he'd had his spiritual awakening, which happened when he was 29. Yet another sharp left turn into Crazy Town. The story aired a few weeks later on both Sunday World News and Nightline. The reactions from my colleagues were interesting. A few of them wrote Tolle off as a whack job. Several others said they found him oddly compelling. My friend Jean Marie, for example, described him as being like a Yule log, initially boring, but ultimately mesmerizing. Personally, the encounter had left me in a funny spot. I definitely didn't think Tolle was a fraud. I'd interviewed hucksters, prosperity preachers, child slave dealers, Saddam Hussein flunkies who vowed to turn back the U.S.-led invasion, but this guy didn't give off the I'm full of shit and I know it vibe at all. Maybe he was simply deluded, impossible for me to tell. Essentially, I was right back where I was the first time I peered into the pages of his strange little book, fascinated yet frustrated. Tolle had opened something up for me, a window into the enfeebling clamor of the ego, but he had not answered my most pressing questions. How do you tame the voice in your head? How do you stay in the now? Was it really possible to defeat the gray Stalinism of self-absorption without ending up on a park bench? I was not about to let this drop. It was as if I'd met a man who told me my hair was on fire and then refused to offer me a fire extinguisher. The ego is constantly comparing itself to others. It has us measuring our self-worth against the looks, wealth, and social status of everyone else. Did this not explain some of my worrying at work? The ego thrives on drama. It keeps our old resentments and grievances alive through compulsive thought. Is this why I would sometimes come home to Bianca scowling over some issue at the office? Perhaps the most powerful Tolian insight into the ego was that it is obsessed with the past and the future at the expense of the present. We live almost exclusively through memory and anticipation, he wrote. We wax nostalgic for prior events during which we were doubtless ruminating or projecting. We cast forward to future events during which we will certainly be fantasizing. But as Tolle pointed out, it is quite literally always now. He liked to capitalize that word. The present moment is all we've got. We experienced everything in our past through the present moment, and we will experience everything in the future the same way. I was a pro, I realized, at avoiding the present, a ringer. This had been true my whole life. My mom always described me as an impatient kid rushing through everything. In eighth grade, an ex-girlfriend told me, when you have one foot in the future and the other in the past, you piss on the present. Now, as a grown-up in the deadline-dominated world of news, I was always hurtling headlong through the day, checking things off my to-do list, constantly picturing completion instead of calmly and carefully enjoying the process. The unspoken assumption behind most of my forward momentum was that whatever was coming next would definitely be better. Only when I reached that ineffable whatever would I be totally satisfied. Some of the only times I could recall being fully present were when I was in a war zone or on drugs. No wonder one begat the other. It finally hit me that I'd been sleepwalking through much of my life, swept along on a tide of automatic, habitual behavior. All of the things I was most ashamed of in recent years could be explained through the ego, chasing the thrill of war without contemplating the consequences, replacing the combat high with coke and ecstasy, reflexively and unfairly judging people of faith, getting carried away with anxiety about work, neglecting Bianca to tryst with my BlackBerry, obsessing about my stupid hair. It was a little embarrassing to be reading a self-help writer and thinking, this guy gets me. But it was in this moment, lying in bed late at night, that I first realized that the voice in my head, the running commentary that had dominated my field of consciousness since I could remember, was kind of an asshole. This is where things got confusing, though. Just as I was coming to the conclusion that Tolle was a sage who perhaps held the key to all of my problems, he started saying some ludicrous shit. It was no longer his rococo writing style that was throwing me. I was getting used to that. No, now what was sticking in my craw was his penchant for making wild, pseudoscientific claims. He argued that living in the present moment slowed down the aging process and made the molecular structure of the body less dense. He asserted that thoughts have their own range of frequencies, with negative thoughts at the lower end of the scale and positive thoughts at the higher.